Morning. I appreciate your willingness to stay, Claire, to the very end here at our conference. Again, the title of mine is Christian Engineer and Entrepreneur, How Are They Related? I wanted to give you a little bit of background of who I am so you understand it. First, you see here the nice, pretty logo of Baylor University. We are the oldest university in the state of Texas. We're not the biggest, but we are the oldest. And we're proud to say that we are chartered by the Republic of Texas. So I'll start off with a rhetorical question. Is this a Christian water purifier? This picture is taken at the Sunrise School in Musanze, Rwanda. And then the question is, were the people who designed and installed it doing Christian technical entrepreneurship? I hope to be able to answer that question this morning. A little bit of a background for me. I became a Christian in the fall of 1971 when I was a junior in metallurgical engineering at the Colorado School of Mines. I got 2 degrees from Mines, and then because I wasn't really raised in the church, I wanted to explore theological things, so I went to Denver Seminary and graduated with an MA degree. And something that overlaps some of the entrepreneurship things I'm going to talk about, I have done mission trips. I spent one whole summer in the Philippines. I've been to the Republic of Georgia when it was still in the Soviet Union, to Kenya, Tanzania, Honduras, and I've now, after this spring, been to Rwanda 4 times in the last 4 years. As an engineer, after I got my first 2 degrees, I worked for 5 years as a metallurgical engineer for a steel company in North Central Ohio, and then I spent the last 26 years as an engineering professor. I've been 20 years at Louisiana Tech University, and now 6 years at Baylor. I've done a little bit of entrepreneurship personally. I've been the sole employee of a small engineering consulting company, which is basically me, and I've done things like accident reconstruction and failure analysis over the years. With another professor and my graduate student, I helped start a small electrical company in Honduras, and I'll tell you more about that. I have to admit, it was not successful. We had good technology, but we didn't meet the customer's needs, which is one of the issues we're going to talk about. And I've worked with a number of students who were starting or thinking of starting a company. Why do I care? My personal interest is mostly in the social entrepreneurship side of entrepreneurship. But this presentation is much broader than just social entrepreneurship. And if that's not a term you're familiar with, we'll define it shortly. But one of my goals from a Christian perspective is I want to help people in developing countries to improve their standard of living. I see there's a lot of biblical things we could use to justify why we are involved in the developing world. Let me give you a couple of quotations from Jesus. In Matthew 25, when he talks about the sheep and the goats, the righteous answer him, "When did we see you hungry and feed you, thirsty and give you something to drink?" You know, he says that group will ask that question, "When did we see you sick or in prison or go to visit you?" And the king will reply, "I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me." One that is very convicting to me is just a phrase that Jesus said in Luke 12:48, "From everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked." This really came home to me in January of 2008. I arrived in Rwanda on New Year's Day, and I've realized that by January 3rd, I'd already earned more money as a university professor than the average Rwandan will earn in the entire year. And, you know, God's given me much. Lots of it was just an accident from human terms of where I grew up at and where I went to school. I don't think those are accidents from God's perspective, but from human terms, they might be seen that way. But God has given me a great deal, and I have an obligation to go do something with it. And I think that's true for everybody here. God's given us all a great deal, whether it's intellect and ability, economics, or whatever. And I think that we have an obligation to use the skills that God has given us. We have a growing involvement with technical entrepreneurship at Baylor University, of which I've played a significant part in. One of the issues is we wanted to create some courses that introduce our engineering students to that. And whenever you want to create a course or two and add it to the curriculum, the always question is, well, what are you going to cut out of the curriculum? Because we have a mandate, you will not increase the number of semester hours. So we create a two-course sequence. The first one we call Global Business, Economics, and Communication. And that's co-taught by an engineering professor and an English professor. And then we have a second course called Technical Entrepreneurship, which is taught in our business school, but it's by an entrepreneur, who, all of whose degrees are actually in engineering. And to add this, we had to allow some subtraction. So what we persuaded our faculty is that in these two courses, we can cover the material of technical writing and of engineering economics. And we had to do this a couple times and do tests and have them take the same test the engineering econ students took to verify that they really were learning the material. So this is not an obligation. Students do not have to take these two courses, but it is an option. I would say of our 50 ME graduates last spring, probably about a fourth of them did this option. We've been involved, some of our faculty and students, with two different companies. Village Energy is the one in Honduras that did not work out very well. Holtree is one that Dr. Walter Bradley and some of his graduate students have started making parts out of coconuts. And they're on the verge of getting some major contracts from the auto industry. That looks like that will be very successful. They have a motive of helping poor coconut farmers around the world. They will also create jobs in Waco, Texas, as well as provide opportunities for engineering graduates. We also have a high technology entrepreneurship program involved in China, where our students and Chinese students work on real-world problems of companies that work in China. And we have two of our engineering professors in China as we speak. This last May, I went to Rwanda and met with a couple of university presidents to look at how we could do joint entrepreneurial engineering things with them. There's one school in that whole country that teaches engineering, and I think we can work out a deal where we could do some joint work with them. One of the other things that took a lot of discussion is those of you who are engineers, engineering faculty, know about our favorite four-letter word, ABET, which controls our accreditation. They're an accreditation agency for engineering. And we have a number of official educational objectives. And what we did in mechanical engineering this spring is we added one more objective to it. This isn't all of our objectives. This is one of them. But we say we want to educate and equip servant leaders who are empowered by innovative problem-solving, creativity, and an entrepreneurial mindset. Now, we carefully chose those words, entrepreneurial mindset, in the context that engineers who work in industry need to be entrepreneurial thinkers to sell their projects even to their supervisor. So it's not just creating people who can start companies, although we want to do that. I mean, help students know how to start companies. We also want them to have this entrepreneurial innovation mindset wherever they go work at. We have gotten involved with a group that goes by the acronym KEEN. It's really the Kern Entrepreneurship Education Network, sponsored by the Kern Family Foundation. We have about 20 private universities in this group who's working on helping our engineering students become more entrepreneurially minded. This foundation works only with private schools because they see them as less bureaucratic. About half of the private schools are faith-based schools, some of whom have science faculty here at this conference. And one of the terms that we use a lot in there is intrapreneurship, and that's this entrepreneurial mindedness within big corporations or even medium-sized corporations. And certainly we see this as important, in many ways more important than just starting a new company. We want our engineers to be innovative and willing to try and create new things, whether they work for a big company or whether they're starting one on their own. We have worked in this group to try to figure out what does it you need to be a technical entrepreneur. And we have come up with this pyramid where there's four aspects to it I want to talk about, that you need to have some technical fundamentals if you're going to start a business that's based on technology. You've got to know the technology, and you've got to have technology that works. You've got to know something about business. There's a lot of people who have great technology, but if no one wants it, it won't work. I'm reading right now a fascinating book called Innovate Like Edison. And some of Edison's first inventions were really technologically brilliant, but nobody wanted them. So they didn't sell. You know, and really, on the other hand, when he invented the incandescent light bulb, he had to create a whole electrical industry to support the power so people would want to buy light bulbs. So there is a business acumen aspect. You've got to respond to your customer needs. As I'll talk about in a few minutes, sometimes that's not always obvious who your customer is, particularly in social entrepreneurship. And you have to reflect societal values, which I would say you need to reflect our personal Christian values as well as the values of the culture with which you are working. So these are the four aspects of the pyramid that our group has decided are things we need to work on if we want engineers to be successful technical entrepreneurs. And we believe at Baylor that being a Christian technical entrepreneur affects all four of those. In technical fundamentals, it affects what you want to do with the technology. It certainly affects how you treat people in business. It affects what you see your customers as, and certainly it reflects respecting the values of the culture in which you are working. One of the critical things that's important in entrepreneurship is motive. A lot of people think of entrepreneurs, they think of Bill Gates, and hey, if I start a business, I'll have $20 billion or whatever he has. But most people don't make that much money. And the point is, there's a lot of research that indicates if your sole goal in entrepreneurship is to make a lot of money, you probably won't, and your company probably won't work because you may cut corners and do things that are counterproductive. That most successful entrepreneurs are motivated by a desire to meet real needs of real people because they've created some new product or some new service. And some of them will be enormously successful, some will be moderately successful, and it depends on what you describe as being necessary to be successful. But the idea is you should be motivated largely by a desire to satisfy some need that is out there. Well, you need to understand the technical fundamentals. One of them is you need to understand the technical ability to design and manufacture your product. If you're going to be an engineering entrepreneur, you need to know the engineering discipline behind the technology. And I'm not going to go much more into that because I think that's pretty obvious. But what I want to spend a few minutes on is the issue of how technology affects society, which is another aspect of technical fundamentals. So you need to know something about what is technology. I'll make a distinction here between Christian engineers and Christian engineering. A Christian engineer is a Christian who is an engineer. Hopefully you're going to be competent and hardworking. You should help create things that are useful to people. But I would say Christian engineering is you're practiced with the explicit goal of advancing God's agenda in the world. Now, I'm not meaning to say anything negative about being a Christian engineer. That's what most Christians who are engineers are. But what I'm thinking from our motive at my university is we want to promote Christian engineering where you're using your skills to help people around the world. And in this sense, I would say that was a Christian water purifier. It was designed by people from a Christian motive. It was installed by people with a Christian motive. Then it didn't work well. And we showed up from Baylor, and we fixed it and got it to work and moved it to a better location where it would work more efficiently. And I would say all of those people in that chain were doing some sort of Christian entrepreneurial activities. When I think of the nature of technology, there's two books that's influenced me. One of them, Responsible Technology, edited by Stephen Monsma. You notice 1986, and some of you may be thinking, hasn't technology changed a lot in 25 years? And I would say at the detail level of what technology can do, obviously PowerPoint and this notebook computer didn't exist 25 years ago. But I would say the way humans interact with technology in a fundamental level has not changed that much. Someone who was here until this morning, Jack Swearingen, has written a very good book. I don't see that as a deliberate sequel to Monsma's book, but it covers a lot of the same things as well as deals with some more modern technology. Beyond Paradise, Technology and the Kingdom of God. And if you want to explore how humans interact with technology, I would recognize these two books. The first book, even though it's a bit old, Amazon still has it, and certainly Amazon has that one. Unfortunately, neither of them are available on Kindle yet, but you can still buy paper and ink versions of them. Another thing that I found is there's another conference that occurs every other year approximately called the Christian Engineering Education Conference. And we usually meet at the same site of the American Society for Engineering Education meeting. So we were in Vancouver, near Vancouver at Trinity Western this summer. two of my friends from Calvin have written interesting papers. Stephen Vanderlees won Bias and Technology from Creation or Fall. Talks about the choice of technology has moral implications. Now, I'm not saying technology is bad or it's good, but it's both in many ways. And then Jeremy Van Antwerp has also written one about engineering as a helping profession. And if you go, just do the Google search on Christian Engineering Education Conference, you can get all their proceedings over the last few years. We have about 15 papers every conference. And there are several that deal with technology, not just those two. But one of the things that Vanderlees said in that first paper there, he says technology is not ethically neutral. It is biased towards certain uses, persuades the user toward particular actions, and has built-in values in its structure. When I say that, even at my Christian university, I get not everybody agrees with me. Yeah. But I've become convinced through Monsma's book and through my own experience and stuff like what Vanderlees has said, that I agree that technology is not neutral. Let me give a comment, an example of that. I think it's pretty true that engineers love technology and most engineers love computers. So the engineers I know want to solve problems that computers can solve because computers can solve them. And we tend to ignore other important problems that may not be as easily solvable by computers. And I'm not saying we shouldn't use computers to solve problems. We all do. But we shouldn't get enamored of it. I faced that this last week when I had to decide, do I want to buy a book on paper and ink or not buy it at all? Because I've gotten so used to buying books on Kindle. And I finally decided I wanted the book more than I cared about the technology. And I have a book and paper and ink waiting on me when I get home. Well, let me give some personal applications of this. One of my professor friends and I and my graduate student attempted to create a village-level energy company in Honduras. Created micro hydroelectric power system to create a battery charging business. We were not successful. It did do the battery charging. That part worked. But the business did not work. And we reported on this 2 years ago in our ASWE paper. We had a nearly complete business failure. Why? The technology wasn't really what the villagers wanted. So they didn't really accept it. And the other issue is it had ethical implications. Is it ethical to start something you cannot sustain? Lots of people who want to do engineering service projects in other countries do that. They start things that cannot be sustained. And you can raise the local people's hopes as they anticipate an improved life, and it's shattered by the system not working or not being sustainable. And one of the issues at stake is our technology by itself worked great, but we didn't look at all the other issues. We still are doing work in Honduras. We haven't given up on that country. One of my colleagues who worked on this product is in Honduras right now. Has been this entire month. Another thing that you need to do is you need to have some business acumen. That's a second corner of the pyramid. You're going to need help from business professionals in starting their company. If all you're going to do is what I did as a sole proprietor of a personal consulting company, I really didn't need much business acumen. You know, I needed to get a tax number. I needed to get a doing business as name with my local county. But I didn't really need much any other business help. But if you're going to do anything beyond just a personal consulting business, you're going to need that. Again, this book I'm reading about Edison, he created a great machine to automatically count votes in the Massachusetts legislature. And they found out that the Massachusetts legislature in the 1800s didn't want an automatic vote counting machine because they wanted to be able to cut deals and switch votes and do all sorts of other things. Yeah. But it was fascinating. His technology worked, but they didn't want it. Okay, I would suggest what we need is kingdom entrepreneurs. You know, you need a authentic, skilled business people who want to create what I would call a kingdom business. And I'll talk in a minute. When I say that, I'm talking about a social entrepreneurship business. They don't consider their work as a hindrance to ministry because they see it as really being their ministry. So let's see how that could play a role. When you talk, when I think of social entrepreneurship, I think of what's commonly called a triple bottom line. Now, everybody that talks about it lists three different things. There's not agreement as to what the three bottom line items need to be. The first one, however, everybody says is that it needs to be profitable. If your company isn't profitable, you cannot sustain it. And if one of your goals is to provide jobs for poor people in a developing country, if your company goes bankrupt in 2 years, the jobs all go away. But by having a triple bottom line, what we're saying is we need to make a profit, but we're not necessarily trying to make the largest profit possible, because then we could be hurting the environment or hurting the people we are trying to help. So everybody who talks about triple bottom line agrees on that one, and what the other two are, different groups have different opinions. We would see one as economic transformation. We're creating jobs in these local communities, and by creating jobs, we are helping them improve their lifestyle. Now, if you're a Christian, you might say spiritual transformation would be another one. You know, if you're speaking from a secular perspective, some people talk about environmental protection. You know, so you could have a quadruple bottom line or however many bottom lines you want, more than just one. The idea is it's more than just one. It needs to be profitable to be sustainable, but you keep the profit in more moderation so you could fulfill some of these other goals at the same time. One of the things you need to do is understand the needs of your customers. Your product must meet a need your customers believe that they have. And that's an important point. The customers believe they have it, not you think they have it. You know, and that if you're working in a different culture, it's not obvious necessarily whether they and you agree as to what is needed. The failed business in Honduras is an example of that. What we thought they needed was not what they wanted. So the idea is, excuse me, a great product is only great if people are willing to buy it. The other thing is, it needs to reflect the values of the society in which you are working. One example would be if you're trying to sell something to upper middle class consumers, it better not only work good, it better look pretty. You know, if you're selling it to poor people, they're going to care about whether it works. But if you're talking about upper middle class consumers, you've got to have an appearance issue. We have actually, a couple years ago, we had an art professor assist one of our senior design teams because they're doing a project for a real company that needed to have something out in the marketplace that not only worked, but looked nice. And most engineers don't have the view of looking pretty as one of their design constraints. It must not disrupt the basic nature of the society. I read a story a few years ago that some Western group created modular homes that could help improve the lifestyle in a particular developing country. But in that country, they had a very rigid system of where the kitchen had to be with respect to the other rooms, and the Westerners put the kitchen in the wrong place. So even though the house was a superior house by our standards, nobody wanted it. They needed to have talked with the local people. They could have created a modular house that fit the designs the local people liked, but they didn't do that. And certainly if you're working in a developing world, you must not be seen as patronizing, that we're the rich Americans who are going to solve your problems. Again, thinking about accreditation, there's a quote from our accreditation agency that says, engineering programs must show their students attain the broad education to understand the impact of engineering students in a global economic, environmental, and societal context. Whenever you try to change the engineering curriculum, in fact, they're going to say, well, what will our accreditation agency think? Well, our accreditation agency will like it if you do this. And the National Society of Professional Engineers, which is what NSPE did, says as their fundamental criterion that we should hold paramount in the safety, health, and welfare of the public with whom we are working. So local impact is important as an engineer. If you're interested in social entrepreneurship ventures, a book by William Oakes and Mary Beth Lima called Service Learning, Engineering in Your Community is a very useful book. Now, that will help you if you're just trying to have a service learning project and you're not even starting a company. Excuse me, because they also look at the issue of how it works with local communities. They say there's a number of things you need to do, think about. You need to think about how your issue is being framed. Realize that technology is value-laden. Use a broader systems thinking. And they say engineering and technical systems should be democratic. Now, they're not saying the local community votes on everything, but they're saying don't put something in a local community if they really don't want it. So in traditional design, engineers try to design what does the customer want. And you still need to do that at all times. But when you're working with local communities, it's not obvious who the real customer is. You know, if we're working with a local nonprofit in Waco, they will tell us what the local community needs, but we may need to get a little behind them to find out, does the local community really want what the nonprofit says they want? So who your customer is in social entrepreneurship ventures is not always obvious. And again, this is another aspect of that, is that engineers frequently don't think about social implications of their designs. And we should think about that. And again, I've said part of this before about engineers love to solve problems with computers. And we need to make sure that we are solving the real problem, and if we could use computers, that's nice. And again, Oakes and Lima talk about democratic design. They're not referring to everybody votes, but it means the local community needs to be involved in the decision-making process. You know, when I go to Rwanda, I'm not just doing what I think some school needs. I'm talking about to the leadership of the school, to the kids in the school, what do you really need? And they all agree at what they need, and that's what we're trying to work on. We need to reflect the values of the society in which you are working. But it also should reflect your Christian values as well. And there may be some tension you have to work through. I'll give an example from Whole Tree, the company that's working with coconut things. And to avoid embarrassing people, I won't mention which developing country they're talking about. They want to help these poor coconut farmers. And certainly the farmers' income will increase as they have more products to sell. But what they've worked out a deal is they're going to pay them not in money but in things. They're going to give them things like, not give them, provide them things like farm tools. The people heavily value education, so scholarships for kids to go to school. You might say, wouldn't paying money be easier? Well, sure it would. But in this particular culture, when a poor farmer gets a little bit of money and escapes the bare minimum level of poverty, the first status symbol he generally goes and does is get his second wife. You know, and we really don't want to increase the rate of bigamy in this country by helping the poor farmers with coconuts. So we're not trying to be patronizing, but we have to be careful to not be seen as patronizing, but work out deals where they actually do benefit in a way that's not inconsistent with our Christian faith. We don't want to increase bigamy in this particular developing country, so they're going to provide payments other than in money. So kind of my conclusion that Christian technical entrepreneurship is more than just entrepreneurship by an engineer who happens to be a Christian. It's more of a deliberate thing that you're trying to do. And again, the four corners of the pyramid that we have adopted as kind of our model for entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs or entrepreneurially minded engineers is you need to understand the technical fundamentals, which means the engineering and the basic technology, but also understanding the issue of technology-human interaction. You need to have either yourself or people with you who understand business acumen. You need to understand the needs of your customer. And again, in social entrepreneurial ventures, that's not always simple because you're typically working with a group who says they're representing the people. And they may well be, but they may not be. And then you need to reflect the societal values that the project should not be offensive to the local community. And certainly, as a Christian technical entrepreneur, it should not be offensive to our Christian faith. I thank you for staying to the very end of our conference. I'm glad that I didn't have a totally empty room. So, thank you very much.